It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard is out today. Coming up in Wisconsin Life, we'll check out a sport that isn't usually associated with Wisconsin. First, Tony Robinson, a black 19-year-old, was shot and killed 4 months ago today by white Madison police officer Matt Kenny. His death sparked protests around Madison and added to an already heated national conversation about race relations and criminal justice. Dane County District Attorney Ishmael Ozan decided not to charge Kenny for the death in May, but activists have continued to call for changes to policing practices and the incarceration rate of Madison's African-American community. Today, the Young, Gifted, and Black Coalition is holding a funeral procession in Robinson's memory. Here with us now is Brandy Grayson, co-founder of that coalition. Brandy, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
To start off, Brandy, what is planned for today?
We're just going to lead a funeral procession in honor of the fourth-month anniversary of the murder of Tony Robinson through the streets of Madison, and ending with us dropping off the casket and symbolizing the burial of him. And the purpose of us doing this is to continue to let people be aware of the trauma that was inflicted on our community at the loss of having one of our children murdered at the hands of a Madison police officer. And we have been continually carrying that burden of his death while the state and city officials have been able to move on and move on with their lives. And Matt Kenny has a job and people, but our people, the community, is still suffering. And also, we need to make sure that people are aware of the lies and the illusions presented by the city and state officials, including the DA. And regarding Tony Robinson's murder, one, Matt McKinney never announced himself. Like, we know this through private investigations. Two, we know that the video that was released by Madison Police Department was edited. We know that that dash cam didn't show everything once our investigation was completed. There's a lot of details regarding the murder of Tony Robinson that was not released by the DA or the Madison Police Department, because it was then made Matt Kenny look guilty, as he is, of the murder of Tony Robinson. So it's up to us as a community to keep his fighting for justice for Tony and to continue to make people aware of the discrepancies in the murder and what we've seen and then what has been released by Madison Police Department.
And you were calling for changes to Madison's criminal justice system before all of this happened 4 months ago. What has changed? How has his death affected your organization, the work you're doing on changing the criminal justice system?
We've moved into more of legal strategies, but we're partnering with organizations and other legal folks across the country because there's a need for us to address the laws that allow these kind of things to happen. And also, we did locate a state ordinance that may allow us to, get justice for Tony Robinson outside of civil lawsuits. You know, so it's about research and information, connecting the dots, meeting with the right people, having the right conversations. The fight for justice for Tony is not over. We are not going anywhere. And what is done for us as a movement and as a coalition is basically made it impossible for us to walk away from the fight for justice in Dane County and in Madison. We can't. We can no longer accept it. Even if we wanted to, when we have the blood of one of our children on the hands of everyone in this community, if we don't do something about it. So we must continue to move in the right path of justice.
Talking to Brandy Grayson with the Young, Gifted, and Black Coalition on the four-month anniversary of the police-involved shooting of Tony Robinson. Now, one of the things I understand the organization's looking for, Brandy, is a United Nations investigation. What are you hoping to get from the UN?
Yes, we are calling a UN investigation for the racial disparities in Dane County as well as in Wisconsin, and the police brutality that African Americans and Black folks are facing in the country. And we're hoping to get other people, other organizations, other cities, other states signed on. We've been very successful in doing that. The more people we have, the more power we have. And we must understand that just because something's legal by state statute or federal statute doesn't make it humane, and it doesn't make it a non-violation of human rights. We're also calling for community control over police, meaning that we desire to for the community to make decisions about hiring and firing of police officers and policies and procedures and setting priorities for police officers and deciding for ourselves what police, the police model looks like in our neighborhoods, which is common to the power that white elite folks have in their neighborhoods and their communities. And we're calling for community control across the country, not in Dane County. You know, we understand that this is for us, it's a country movement. You know, this is something that's affecting us all throughout our country. So we're doing this through all, you know, different network ties, because we understand that the more power, more people that's backing these things, the more power we have.
Are you working with groups like yours in communities like in Ferguson, Missouri, and New York City, other places like that?
Absolutely. In Ferguson, in Ohio, in Detroit, in Chicago, in Milwaukee, in New York, in New Jersey. Yes, and the list keeps going on and on. And today in New York, they will be also holding a solidarity action for Tony Robinson to signify that this Tony is a 360, that Tony was murdered, just like many other black people have been murdered across our country at the hands of a police officer without due process, without justice, without consequence. So it's necessary for everyone across the country to know Tony's name as we know Eric Garner's name.
Now, you mentioned a private investigation, you say, showed discrepancies in evidence that was publicly presented. Are you sharing evidence of that publicly?
We will. You know, that's part of our strategy, right? It's necessary for us to be very careful about what we do and how we do it and how we move. So timing is everything. And when you know what I mean, when we release information, and it's all strategic, just like they were. They were very strategic in how they handled the community and how they handled us through the media and so forth and so far. But so, yeah, you know, yep, we will.
I mean, this would be big information. Do you have an idea of when you would release that?
Yeah, it is huge. Again, that's not something that I can't really give you a time frame for that.
Okay. In a statement from Young, Gifted, and Black, you drew parallels between officer-involved shootings of black men and the mass shooting at a church in Charleston. Can you talk about the parallels you see there?
Absolutely. If we take notice of what happened in Charleston, what we have is a white man who entered a church and murdered 9 black people as a result of white supremacy, that he believes in white supremacy. He believes in the purity of the white blood. He is a product of America. He is an example of what happens when we continue to allow racism to infect us like a virus in our country. He's a product of that. And so is Matt Kenney. And so is anyone else that isn't consciously walking with awareness of what we're dealing with and the reality of what we're dealing with. So, yes, the killing of the 9 folks in South Carolina and Tony Robinson is parallel. It's violent. It's violent. It was violent. And the difference is that, like the murders, the police murders surrounding black folks, we rarely get prosecution. We rarely get prosecution. People are allowed to murder us and walk free, and we get murdered on the streets for a pack of Skittles. We get murdered for cigars. But this dude who walked into this church was able to kill 9 people and live to tell about it. Like it's very telltale about the reality of racism here in America.
So talk a little bit, please, about the relationship between Young, Gifted, and Black and Madison's city government and police, a contentious relationship before Tony Robinson's death and after. How would you describe it today?
Well, you know, I think the difference, I think what I would describe it no different. You know, we sit on one side. We sit on the side of justice, and they sit on the side of politics and legality. We sit on the side of humanity and morality, and they sit on the side of legality and injustice. So, that still remains. Our fight for justice is not a personal one. I have nothing against any of the officers. I have nothing against the chief of police. All I know is that my people are suffering. They're suffering emotionally, physically, mentally, and spiritually and financially and every other way that we can think of. Physically being murdered and killed and slaughtered across our country. So this is not a personal fight for me. This is a fight for my freedom. So this isn't about people individualism. As individuals, this is about a system that they represent.
Brandy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, love, and have a great day.
That was Brandy Grayson, co-founder of the Young, Gifted, and Black Coalition. The organization is marking 4 months since the death of Tony Robinson today with a funeral procession in his memory. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a researcher who's looked at whether or not being nice pays off, both at work and in our personal relationships. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Shauna Singh Baldwin was obsessed with polo as a teenager in India, but hadn't played since moving to Wisconsin. An invitation to the Milwaukee Polo Club reignited her passion for the sport.
One sunny Saturday in July, I succumbed to an invitation to the Milwaukee Polo Club. It came from a friend, Courtney Ross, a nurse who plays polo. I had resisted visiting the club in Merton for years, afraid I'd want to play. My parents had indulged my teenage obsession with polo for 4 years as I played to national championship level and a scratch handicap in Delhi, till I came to Marquette University as a graduate student. Today, even in India, the game is known as a pastime for the champagne and caviar set. Avoiding construction on the expressways, I took Lisbon Avenue and headed north. Soon I spied the mansions of Merton through screens of evergreens and a massive First Baptist Church in a town of only 3,413. All down Main Street to the Polo Club, power lines restrained American flags and leafy boughs. I parked at one end of the 300-yard field. Players weren't riding each other off the line of the ball or galloping. It was a practice chukker, 7.5 minutes of play wafting up seductive scents of grass, sweat lather, and leather. I walked over to the horses and trailers, remembering my mare, Kibala, who lived up to the meaning of her name. What horror! Courtney was braiding the tail of her Kentucky-bred ex-racer, Soko. Her second horse, Hottie, rolled a gelid black eye at me and snorted gently when I kissed her nose. At 15 hands, these American thoroughbreds were taller than the Kathiawari mare I rode in India. Courtney buckled her knee guards, swung into the saddle, and cantered off, mallet in hand. I could not watch. I itched to play. Jim Huber walked over to chat. This 76-year-old retired lawyer is legendary in Milwaukee for booking and organizing Milwaukee's polo games, teams, and sponsors. Milwaukee polo is growing, he said, since announcer Danny Dance began teaching spectators the fine points of strategy. We play blue-collar polo, he said, invitingly. I yearned for that Centaurian oneness with an animal again, a breeze on my cheeks, the visceral crash of the ride-off, the delight of knocking that white ball clear of a melee of furry legs. But I thanked Jim Huber and stood firm. Then I felt a soft weight on my shoulder, Hottie's soft muzzle. Her breath warmed my ear. Polo trains your courage, focuses hand and eye, and teaches the resilience to remount after every fall. Other sports offer these, but only in polo will a horse like Hottie honor you with her cooperation and protection. Next season, maybe I will sign up for just one polo class. Wish me a horse like Hottie.
Shauna Singh Baldwin is the award-winning author of several books, including What the Body Remembers. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more info, go to wisconsinlife.org. Joining us now to tell us more about the sport of polo here in Wisconsin is the legendary Jim Huber, president of the Milwaukee Polo Club in Heartland. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
So a lot of people, if they think polo, they probably don't think Wisconsin. What's the history of polo here in our state?
Actually, Wisconsin has a very, very rich history. Bobby Lyon, president of Schlitz, some 60 years ago, established the Milwaukee Polo Club. And it was one of the first clubs in the country, along with the Oak Brook Polo Club, to hire professional players to play polo. And that broke the ground for the pros entering the sport. And high goal polo was played at Beeline Field on Good Hope for several decades before Bob's passing and the Suns moved to Florida.
So for people who haven't seen the game firsthand, people like me, how does the game of polo work?
It's somewhat like hockey without a goalie. The length of the field is 3 football fields long, 2 football fields wide, 4 men on a team or women on a team. They're all assigned positions, offense, defense, or offense and defense. And there are 6 periods in the game. Obviously, the goal is to get the ball through the goals at the ends of the field.
Now, tell us about the horses you ride when playing polo. Are they different than the horses we saw, in the Kentucky Derby, the other big races?
Well, they're not different, and no, we ride all racehorses. These are thoroughbred horses. We buy them off the tracks at age two or three when their racing career might be coming to an end. Maybe they're going to be five or six at that point. It takes us 2 years probably to get what we call a made horse. That is a horse that's used to the traffic, used to the mallet, used to the ball before they're made. At that point, they should be able to play polo until they're in their early 20s.
Now, what does it take to become a made human in that half of the game? How long does it take before you have confidence to get out there in the chucker and actually play the game?
I think that's relatively short if you get into a school and are taking polo lessons. Horsemanship is the number one factor, I believe, in a successful polo career. But you become so involved with hitting the ball or watching the other players that to some extent you forget that you are on a horse, and you improve much faster at that point because you've got a different emphasis. You're not worried about falling off the horse or having the horse react in a contrary manner. So I think it's a speedier process if you want to get involved in polo. Obviously, it's a real plus if you want to get involved to have ridden and have some horsemanship abilities.
Talking to Jim Huber, president of the Milwaukee Polo Club in Heartland, about the sport of polo here in Wisconsin. Now, is this a spectator sport? Can people show up at the events and see this done in person?
It's a great spectator sport. Milwaukee's known for tailgating. You simply drive out. We have fieldside picnic tables. Park your car alongside the field and enjoy a picnic. Our crowds have increased dramatically, particularly the last 3 years. We'll have anywhere from 400 to 1,000 people to a game.
And as I understand it, I think this is from a movie, you are, if you're in the crowd, obliged to, during breaks to go in and help fix the divots on the course?
That's a tradition. It's the social part of polo of turning over the divots that the horse has made so that the riders have a smooth surface to ride on. What it really amounts to is you get out on the field, maybe take your dog with you, visit with someone and one of your friends, visit and see who can turn over most of the divots.
Now, Shauna said in India and the United States, in that Wisconsin Life piece, that people think of this as a sport of the champagne set. You describe it, though, I hear, as a blue-collar sport. Or you play it blue-collar style. Which is it?
It can be a champagne sport. Perhaps it is in Florida, where our highest goal polo is played. But basically, in my experience throughout the country, it is not. It is a crowd that can go anywhere from the teachers, nurses, machinists, bus drivers, to those who own their own company. You can really get into the sport at a much less cost than you might anticipate trying to get along with one or two horses. So it's both. The fancy polo is in the South or in Florida. But we can take any income player, and they get along fine.
And just showing up and watching the game, will we be able to follow it? You said it's maybe along the lines of hockey. If we get the gist of get the ball through the goal, can we follow what's going on the field?
You can. The fields are huge. Yeah, it's a long distance away if you're 300 yards long and 200 yards wide. So in that respect, the key is to have a good announcer. Danny Dance is a very talented musician on the east side of Milwaukee, has been announcing for us for 20 years, probably the best announcer by far in the Midwest. He's often called to other clubs to announce for them. And so he's a key factor in helping all of our spectators appreciate the game and understand the game.
And I saw on your Milwaukee Polo Club website, somebody there had said one of the things they like best about polo is that it's really multi-generational. You get a really wide variety of people of all ages playing.
Yeah, that's true throughout the country. For example, this past weekend, I played. My son, who lives in Baltimore, umpired. He's usually playing for Baltimore. And my grandson came in and played for our team this past Sunday. So it's if your grandfather played, your father probably did, or your grandmother or your grandson, your father did, or the kids have. And it will carry on. It has throughout the country for decades.
And are you seeing a growing interest in polo in recent years?
There is, primarily due to the number of women entering the sport. Several years ago, not that many were in polo. Today, the women are coming into the sport faster than the men. I think they're better horse persons in getting along with the horses. So if that trend continues, you can expect that at some point you're going to have a large percentage of women playing polo. And they do at times have their own tournaments, but by and large throughout the country, the men are playing on the same team as the men.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us and sharing the sport of polo.
You bet. Thank you.
That's Jim Huber. He's president of the Milwaukee Polo Club. We've been talking about the sport of polo in Wisconsin. I think I want to go see this sometime. I've never been up on a horse, though. I think I better start with some kind of pony ride with a handler first before I'd ever take a plunge like that. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up on Saturday, Governor Scott Walker and Republican legislative leaders announced they're removing a controversial open records overhaul from the state budget. We'll talk to a state capitol reporter about that news. First, does it pay to be nice to people? We often hear that term, nice guys finish last, which people use to explain some negative work and relationship behaviors. A few weeks ago, a Georgetown business professor wrote an op-ed for the New York Times lamenting the decline of civility at work. Nearly 20 years ago, only a quarter of the people she surveyed said they'd been treated rudely at work. But by a few years ago, the number of people reporting rude behavior at work had jumped to over half. Research from the Human Cooperation Laboratory at Yale University looked at the costs and benefits of being nice, and it reached the conclusion that being nice really does pay off. We want to hear from you about this. Do you agree that it pays to be nice, or do you think it's a waste of time? Do you go out of your way to be nice to friends, family members, coworkers? Why do you do it? Just because it's a good thing to do, or because you get something out of it too? Do you think people treat you differently when you're nice? Call and share your experiences at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. David Rand joins us now. He's a professor of psychology, economics, and management at Yale University, and he's the director of Yale's Human Cooperation Lab. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks a lot for having me.
So a short version, it sounds like being nice is good for an individual, good for a business as a whole. How does a cooperation lab measure that kind of thing, though?
So there's two different ways we think about these questions. One is using sort of math and computer simulations and game theory kind of things. But then the other big part is we run lots of experiments. Some of them are lab experiments where we have people come into the lab and we give them money, and then they have the choice to either keep the money for themselves or pay the money to help other people. And we, you know, look at what strategies people use and what winds up working well for them. And then we also do field experiments with real organizations out in the world, to see how these things from the lab translate into the real world.
So how does being nice play out, say, in an office or a workplace environment? What, apart, again, from the intrinsic niceness of being nice, what do I get out of it?
So the key thing to remember is that when you have an interaction with someone, that's typically, particularly in the work context, that's not the only time you're going to interact with that person. And so your actions today have consequences in the future. So you might think, well, I could take advantage of this person right now and that would, you know, get me some short-term gain. But when you do that, you forget that there's going to be a long-term cost, because the next time that you're in a position where you need something from that person or they have the chance to take advantage of you, if you do today, that will lead them to take advantage of you tomorrow, whereas if you're helpful towards them, that can make them be inclined to help you in the future.
Now, your research takes it a step further, David. It's not just reciprocity. I'm nice to you now, you're nice to me next time. You say it pays off to be nice to someone even after they've stepped on you in one way or another two or even three times.
Right. So the idea is that this reciprocity is a key concept, but the issue is that in real life, a lot of the time there's a chance for mistakes. where I mean to do the thing that is helpful to you, but through some force beyond my control, either I can't come through with what I was supposed to do, or I'm confused about what's actually going to be helpful for you, and so I wind up doing something that's actually not helpful to you. And so if you're playing a strategy that says, the minute someone screws me over once, I cut them off forever, that can be really costly for you, because you can have these really valuable relationships that wind up getting destroyed because somebody makes a mistake, and then the minute they make a mistake, you cut them off. That can really be costly.
Now, and a counter argument I imagine a lot of people are thinking now is, aren't there a lot of rich and famous successful people who are jerks? I mean, Steve Jobs of Apple is known, I think, even among people who like him, as a difficult person to work with. He did well. His company, obviously, Apple, did very well. We can all probably think of famous movie stars, music stars who have done quite well while stepping on the people underneath them. So what about them?
Yeah, so, you know, these are sort of general principles rather than absolute rules that hold in all cases. But it's typically the case that when you have these kind of repeated interactions, that it's always the case that there are going to be future consequences. It could be, if you are like really amazingly brilliant, that you can get away with being a jerk because people will want to work with you anyways. But like for the rest of us, you know, a big part of who you want to work with, who you want to sort of help, be willing to help, is have they helped you before in the past? And another thing that's really important is that the fact that future consequences exist can make cooperating pay off. So if the other people in your office are all using a strategy that says, I will be helpful to you so long as you're helpful to me, then that makes the office as a whole better off, it makes everyone individually better off, and it makes it so it's in your self-interest to be cooperative today so that you reap the benefits of reciprocal cooperation in the future. But it's also true that if you're in an office where the social norm is, no matter what you do, I'm going to try and take advantage of you, then even though the interaction is repeated, there's no incentive to be cooperative because the other people are going to exploit you. But so it's possible that you are in an environment where if everybody else is being non-cooperative, then it doesn't make sense for you to be cooperative. But if you're in an environment where other people are willing to cooperate as long as you do, then it becomes better for everyone to cooperate. And so if you are like a manager of a business or an organization, a big part of the challenge is to try and establish a norm and a culture whereby people cooperate and you know, you get this kind of reciprocal cooperation going.
Talking to David Rand with Yale's Human Cooperation Lab about the benefits of being nice. He says in many cases, based on his research, we really do get ahead by getting along. We're kind to others. They're kind to us. It helps all of us and maybe the organization we're part of as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And we've got Kat on the line in Green Bay. Kat, hi. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Actually, I have threefold on the issue that you're discussing, because I've been on both sides. When I used to bartend, being nice actually gave me more tips. So everybody else wanted to work with me because people were willing to wait an extra 15 minutes and still tip me quite well because I was nice and pleasant. Now, on the other side of the coin, if somebody is nice and pleasant, say I'm taking my car into a shop, and they actually treat me like a person, and they're nice and pleasant, they may be $100 more expensive for changing my muffler or whatever, but I'll keep going back to them. They will automatically have my business. Now, in return, what I've also noticed, and things that we don't seem to keep in the city I'm in right now, I don't seem to notice a lot of people doing the same, is that somebody's having a bad day, the cashier at Target or the grocery store is having a bad day, and I actually look into their eyes and tell them to have a pleasant day, and tell them how much I appreciate that they're doing this, that they're, yes, it's their job. They actually smile, and then they ask the next customer as I'm leaving, how are you? And it seems to cause quite a chain reaction.
Wow.
When you're being polite. At least it is with me.
Kat, thank you so much. Well, Dave, she brings up a lot there. She has experienced economic benefit from being nice, she says, but I suspect she'd do it even without that benefit. She rewards others with economic benefit. She'll patronize a business that's nicer, even if it's a bit more expensive. We'll stop there. I mean, is that the kind of thing you see in your real-world research and in your experiments?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly the kind of thing that we're thinking about, is those kinds of, like, if you are nice, people are more inclined to reward you, and similarly, you're more inclined to reward people that are nice. And so for both of those reasons, it's both of those reasons together create a system in which it becomes in everyone's self-interest to be nice. And I just want to point out one other thing, which is that it's true that it is typically pays, but as you said, a lot of people, and I think most people, often are nice just because it feels good, not because they're doing some kind of calculation of, oh, look, this is going to be in my, you know, self-interest. But we've done a lot of work arguing that a lot of why it feels good is because we learn to feel good doing cooperative things because cooperative things are typically rewarded. And so you wind up internalizing that good feeling of like, oh, it's nice, it feels nice to help other people because that's actually a good strategy.
Before I take another caller, Kat also mentioned, in effect, a contagion effect of being nice. She's nice to someone, then she sees them being nice to someone else. Is that something you've seen or tried to figure out in your research?
Definitely. So this is called a like pay it forward kind of effects or contagion, social contagion. We've definitely done a bunch of work on social contagion, and it's something that is a widely documented phenomena. And there's at least a couple of different things going on there. One of them is that if you're used to living in a world where there's a lot of this reciprocity going on, then you come up with a general rule of thumb, which is if people are nice to me, I should be nice. And so even though it's not sort of actually in your interest to be nice to the next person rather than the person who is nice to you because you're not actually reciprocating, it's just kind of this reciprocal circuit gets triggered. And then the other thing is, like I was saying before, where there are these social norms that if you're in an environment where other people are cooperative, then it's good for you to be cooperative, whereas if you're in an environment where other people are selfish, then it's good for you to be selfish. And so when someone is nice to you, that gives you a signal that this is an environment where it's actually good to be cooperative.
Back to our callers with Rod in Madison. Rod, hi.
How you doing? Thanks for taking my call. You know, maybe it's generational for me, but I just think that the nice portion of it is very hard for me to grasp because, you know, I would emphasize more that people should be respectful, and but they should be fair. I mean, when you're in a work environment, you got to get things done. I feel like nice people focus on, you know, doing what somebody asked them to do, but fair and respectful people force you to go where you might not want to go, but you have to go there in order to get the job done. And I think of my kids who are in their early 20s, nice is almost equated to how you make them feel as opposed to pushing the responsibilities that they're obligated to fulfill. So maybe it's the way I'm interpreting nice, but I look more at the what we have to get done. And I might not be extremely nice about it, but I'll try to be fair and professional and respectful, but I'm not grasping the emphasis of how nice I am about it.
Rod, thanks a lot for the call. So we've focused on the word nice, Dave, and maybe we need to define it, but maybe this is a case, the distinction Rod's making between if I'm bending over backwards to do all the stuff that you should be doing, that's a little too nice. It's not helping anybody as long as I'm being polite, respectful, and holding everybody to a high standard. That still meets our positive definition of a good workplace interaction, right?
Yeah, for sure. So this is a really good point that the word nice is misleading here. In sort of technical terms, what we mean when we talk about cooperation is doing something that is costly for you but beneficial for one or more other people, where the costs aren't necessarily dollars and cents but time or effort or whatever. So and typically it's you incur a cost to provide a benefit to someone else that's bigger than the cost that you are providing. So for example, if someone's under a really tight deadline and they need your help to finish a project, you put in some time, and that's costly to you because you could have been doing something else with that time, but because they're on a deadline, it's extremely valuable for them to get the help, and so that sort of like increases the size of the pie for everyone. Or to go with the baking analogy, when you think about asking your neighbor to lend you some sugar, because you're out of sugar and you're trying to bake something, that sugar is more valuable to you than it is to your neighbor. And so when they give you that sugar, it sort of makes everyone overall better off. And so there's lots of examples of things that wouldn't count as nice in a traditional sense and are examples of the kind of thing that the caller was saying that would very much fit this definition, where someone is doing something that is costly for themselves but is making the other person even better off.
We're talking to David Rand about his research in the Human Cooperation Lab at Yale, showing that it pays to cooperate, be kind, get along with our coworkers and other people in our lives. We're taking your calls to, in your experience, does it pay to be nice, to get along, to work with our coworkers, help out when we can? Do people treat you better when you are nice, when you're helpful to them? Or do you need to be a jerk every now and then to get ahead in life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up the discussion, maybe hear from you, after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation with David Rand. He's with the Human Cooperation Lab at Yale University. He's explaining his research on the behavioral economics of kindness, which shows that being nice, that cooperating, can pay off. What do you think about this? Is being nice just a waste of your time? Do you feel taken advantage of when you're helpful at your workplace? Or do you focus on being helpful, maybe helping somebody finish that project at the last minute? Do you feel like you're treated differently, better? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. So, Dave, if somebody wants to change their workplace or other organization, and right now it's a shark tank, everybody's in it for themselves, they're not cooperating, there's no benefit for an individual in being nice, how could someone, maybe a boss, a new boss, change that environment?
It's a really good question, and that's one of the things that we're most interested in and sort of actively studying right now, is sort of the question of how do you change the culture of an organization. And at least one thing that you can do is that you, if you're the boss, you can, or the sort of, you know, the leader of the organization, you can set up certain rules, institutional rules, that reward people for being cooperative. And typically, I would think not reward them in terms of paying them, but giving people recognition, saying, hey, this person went out of the way to do this really nice thing for this other person, and that's great for the organization, and we really sort of respect and admire this, and like, good for that person. These kind of things where you recognize people for doing cooperative actions both makes that person feel good and makes them more inclined to do it, and also communicates to everyone else in the organization that this is a place where people do cooperative things, where people are willing to help each other, and that's something that's valued.
Is this a trend in the country, in the business world, say, that companies are recognizing that they need to build this culture of cooperation?
I think so. I think that I think that there was, in say the 80s, there was this this idea of naked self-interest as, you know, on markets and stuff like that as the core to human behavior, basically, and everyone's only out for themselves, and that means, you know, stomp on top of the other guy and climb to the top of the mountain. And I think that there has been a realization that started in the social sciences and I think is now is permeating out into the greater culture that when you are in this world of repeated interactions and future consequences, it actually turns out that being cooperative and helpful is the thing that winds up maximizing your payoff. And we actually find in some of our experiments that the most selfish people often wind up being the most cooperative when the rules are set up in the right way, such that cooperating really is what earns you money.
Talking to David Rand from Yale University about some of the social science and economics between cooperation and kindness. Back to your calls now. We've got Tom on the line in Waupaca. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. I'm a criminal defense attorney, and so often people think it would be helpful if I was a jerk to the prosecutor or to the complaining witness, but I found out over 25 years of practice that it works out much better if I'm nice to the prosecutor, nice to the witnesses, nice to the jury, and nice to opposing counsel, just because as your program has been saying, you know, when if you're going to work at a place for 20 years, there comes payback time, and
right.
You need to build some credibility and some goodwill with the people that you're going to work with over the decades.
And Tom, I got to ask, what about jurors? I mean, do you think that they look more favorably on the case you're making if you present yourself as a nice fella?
Well, absolutely. And I have to say, just 2 weeks ago, I lost a jury trial. I think it was because I was being sort of insulting to the prosecutor. And I'm thinking he was so gracious to me. And I think the jury liked the way he treated me better than the way I treated him. So I'm still learning that lesson.
Tom, thank you so much. Well, Dave, if I ever thought of a profession where you want somebody to be an angry pit bull, this is it, the criminal defense attorney. But no, Tom says.
Yeah, totally. That makes complete sense to me.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Tom. So, I mean, in a profession like that, again, how maybe there are other attorneys out there listening or other places where people think, I need to be mean, I need to be a jerk to do my job right. What would it take for them to rethink that and get it more into this cooperative get-along mindset?
Well, I mean, that's a major motivation for my research and also for why I like doing things like, you know, talking on radio shows like this, is that I feel like there is this real misunderstanding amongst a lot of people about thinking of, oh, that helping other people and being cooperative is just being weak. But I think that when you think about it and when you reflect on these kind of things, you realize, oh, wait, when we have future consequences, when we have long-term relationships, it really, what I do is going to come back around to affect me. And so I think the more this kind of knowledge gets spread, the more people will be inclined to realize, oh, actually, I should be cooperating, and we should all be cooperating with each other, and it'll make us all better off.
Back to our callers. Beth is with us in Duluth. Beth, hi.
Hi there.
Oh, what do you think, Beth?
I think it's definitely this is the right track to go, the kindness track. I was raised to be kind to people without any expectation, any return, any payout, but boy, has it paid off in my job. I take even the grumpies and I just try to make them look as good as possible and help them out whenever I can. And it really comes back to me. When I need help, then people are willing to drop everything and help me because I've helped them. And then it's also put me in a good standing with my bosses because, if they want something like right now, I'm able to get on my hands on it right now, because other people are willing to drop everything and help me out. So I think it's whether you experience that or not, you can go home at the end of the day feeling good because you treated people respectfully.
Beth, thanks so much for the call. Another case study there, Dave. As we wrap up, I'm going to ask you a huge question with not much time. Are we inherently built, do you think, to be cooperative in this way?
I've done a lot of work showing that that most people have a strong intuitive response to be cooperative, but I don't think it's about evolution and that kind of being built. I think it's about learning, and I think it's that we learn over the course of our lifespans that, like, you know, as kids we're always sort of rewarded for being nice and punished for not being nice, and you sort of pretty quickly learn that the way to be successful is to be cooperative if you're in a culture and a world where that's what is being rewarded.
Well, Dave, thank you so much for being with us. Very interesting.
Thank you for the invitation. It was very nice to talk to you.
That was David Rand. He's a professor of psychology, economics, and management at Yale University. He's also the director of Yale's Human Cooperation Lab. With us to talk about his research showing that it pays to be nice. You can keep sharing your stories, by the way, and see a link to some related research over at the Central Time Facebook page. Well, maybe I'll start being nice to, you know, Veronica and the producers here and Michelle at the board. I know, it's a tall order. Nobody believes it's going to happen.